This is Crime Binge.
Welcome to Crime Binge, the podcast. My name is Morgan.
And I'm Sarah.
And this week, we are on episode 63, where we are finally finishing up our three-part series on Richard Ramirez.
Thank God. I'm kind of over it.
Yeah, we are glad to be done with him, get the Night Stalker out of here, but yes. We do have to finish it up. We can't just leave him hanging, you know what I mean, after all those murders.
We certainly do. And, like, I feel like with the amount of knowledge we have, we could write a book on him now.
Yeah, for sure.
We really do have to thank the book that we read as a source, because it was a large source in... I don't know what I'm saying.
That was a very cheesy segue, and I appreciated it. But what I think you're trying to say is we used the book The Night Stalker by Philip Carlo a lot for our research, along with other sources. But it was a main source.
Yes, and it was a really good book. Like we said before, it kind of drags on sometimes, but, you know, trial shit and all that drags on sometimes.
Yeah, and when you get to, like, talk to the serial killer, you get to know a lot more about all of the things that weren't quite present in the media. So, it happens.
Very true.
But before we get into the trash that is Richard Ramirez, what are you binging this week, Sarah?
So this week I took a break from podcasts and binged a Netflix show.
Okay.
And I just, like, Googled it to get some background information, and it has a 15% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Solid.
But it's called Hoops. It's really fucking dumb. It's like one of those animated shows, like BoJack Horseman or Big Mouth, stuff like that. And there's only one season. It's 10 episodes, so it took me like a fucking day to get through, and it was just something to watch, like, while I cleaned. But basically, it's about this high school basketball coach who just, like, says fuck all the time, and he's angry, and it's just, like, his life and trying to, like, make it as a basketball coach, but everyone shits down his throat.
Interesting.
But Jake Johnson, who's the guy who plays Nick on New Girl, he plays the main character and he's one of the producers. And so I'm all about him.
Fair enough.
And so, I mean, it was like, it was really dumb, but it was really entertaining, and it was easy to watch because I watched all of those, like, Family Guys and animated shitty TV series. It was up my alley, definitely.
You like what you like.
That is true. What is your binge?
My binge this week is going to be YouTube again, because y'all know I love me some YouTube.
Same.
And it's going to be Bailey Sarian.
Yes! I've been waiting for one of us to do her.
Like, you probably know who she is if you also are into true crime. She has, I think, like, over 2 million YouTube followers. Subscribers, how old am I? And she's just a lot of fun. She does true crime and makeup Mondays. It's actually called Murder Mystery Mondays. And she just, like, does a makeup look while she is talking about true crime. And it's really fun. It sounds like you're just, like, talking to a friend about it. And it's really easy to put on in the background. And she's just so conversational with it that it's, like, a really fun and different way to listen to true crime.
It is. And her makeup looks are phenomenal.
Yeah. And a lot of people, like, take issue with it, saying, like, it's rude to do your makeup and stuff. And she's like, I'm literally just, like, doing a makeup look to tide myself over while I'm talking about something horrible, which I totally understand.
Yeah. I, on the other hand, get drunk while we do this.
There you go. But yeah, that's my binge for this week. I've been watching her for a while now, but I just, like, went through a ton of videos.
Yeah.
You know? So, that's my binge.
Alrighty. So, are we ready to get into it?
Yeah, let's get into it.
Okay, so to remind you where we left off last week, basically we ended the episode with Richard Ramirez's name being known by the police and them doing a press conference saying that we know who you are and his picture is everywhere.
Yeah, he's basically like a very wanted man at this point.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so on Friday, August 30th, Richard got onto a Greyhound bus in L.A. to travel to Tucson, Arizona, in order to visit his brother, Robert, Robert's wife, Samantha, and their two-year-old daughter, Betty. Cute. Cute name.
It is.
When he got on the bus, Richard had not seen the press conference and had no idea that he had been linked to the murders and that his name and mugshot were everywhere.
So he's just living, like, oblivious.
Yeah, just going out in public, not hiding his face at all. While on the bus, he of course listened to heavy metal music on his Walkman, probably AC/DC, let's be real. When he got off the bus at the bus station in Arizona, he called Robert. Samantha picked up the phone and said that Robert was not home, but should be home soon. And she also didn't invite Richard to come to the house to wait for Robert to get home, which most people would probably think is weird because you guys are like, oh, that's my sister-in-law. But this is because Richard and Robert had previous issues when Richard was accused of hitting on and saying inappropriate things to Samantha. Richard and his brother actually didn't speak for a few years because of this, but had recently started talking again and pretended like nothing had ever happened. Let's just sweep that one under the rug.
Exactly. And apparently he had also had, like, similar accusations with other family members.
Yeah, that's not what you want at all.
Yeah, still not a great guy.
Yeah. You want to be able to trust your own family around your significant other, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, Richard waited around for a while at the bus terminal, but while he was there, he noticed some plainclothes officers walking around. And obviously, this made Richard uncomfortable, so he called Samantha again. When she said that Robert was still not home, he decided it would be in his best interest to leave. He actually wanted to continue on back to El Paso, Texas, to see his family, but didn't have enough money for this ticket all the way to Texas, so he just bought one back to LA. What Richard didn't know was that the cops were actually there to be on the lookout for him, as the LAPD told the police in Tucson that Richard had a brother who lived there. Richard wasn't noticed by the police as he got back on the bus to LA. This bus was scheduled to arrive in LA at 7:45 a.m. on August 31st. When he was getting on, he dropped his Walkman and lost the batteries, so he was bored on his ride home because he couldn't listen to AC/DC anymore.
What a shame.
So sad for him.
Right? So, when the bus got back to the LA station, there were 15 police officers there on guard, thinking that Richard may flee LA County. However, the cops were only paying attention to the terminals leaving LA, not the ones coming back in, so Richard just casually walked through the bus station.
You know, I totally get it, but let's just have a lookout everywhere.
Right?
You know what I mean?
He did notice some plainclothes police officers in the bus station, so he decided to leave quickly. After leaving, he bought a nickel bag of pot, which I have never heard of a nickel bag of pot.
Me either. It's cute, though.
Yeah. And headed towards a convenience store called Mike's Liquor Store on South Town Avenue. While here, he bought himself a coffee and a pastry. Before leaving, he noticed some elderly women in the back of the store pointing at him and kind of looking afraid. He heard one of them say, "El Matador," which means the killer. Confused, Richard looked down at the news rack he was standing next to and saw his name and mugshot all over the front page of every newspaper.
That would be a big yikes.
Oh, yeah. So he snatched a copy of one of the newspapers and hurried out of the store. What he didn't know was that the owner of the store had already called the cops. So Richard starts running. He went through yards and jumped multiple fences. He left the backpack he was carrying in some random yard as it was just slowing him down. He was headed for the highway. He got to the highway and ran across it, but he almost got hit, which would have just been hilarious.
Yeah.
He managed to catch a bus on the east side of the highway, But as soon as he sat down, the people on the bus started pointing at him. So he got off the bus as soon as it stopped.
Yeah, my guy, your face is literally everywhere and everyone has been hearing about this murderer.
So Richard's, like, ultimate plan was to steal a car and just drive down south to Mexico, where he believed that he could blend in. As he was walking, people outside their homes started recognizing him and calling the police. Three teenage boys started following him, and when Richard noticed, he turned around, told them that he had a gun, and to get the fuck away. Yeah. And they did.
Yeah, I would too.
He heard police sirens and helicopters coming from every direction. A little after 8 a.m., Richard spotted a woman named Manuela sitting alone in her running car outside of a grocery store. She was waiting for her boyfriend to purchase some things and come back out. She saw Richard running towards her, and once he got to her, he told her that his mother had died and he just needed the car. When she said no, he told her that he had a gun and tried pulling her out of the car by her arm. The woman started screaming for help as her boyfriend came out of the store and he started running towards her. Another man who was in the parking lot saw what was happening and also started running towards them. When Richard saw the two men running, he took off. While on the run, he was again cutting through people's yards and hopping fences. He hopped the fence into the backyard of a man who was cooking on his barbecue grill. When the man asked Richard what the fuck he was doing, Richard didn't answer, so the man just whacked him with a long spatula he was using to grill with, so Richard hopped another fence and left.
Yeah.
And I think, to me, it's so funny because I think of the scene in The Office where it's like they're at an arcade and Dwight is like trying to hit on Isabella and Angela's trying to like get involved, and at the end Isabella just goes whack and whacks Angela in the head. Like, that's all that I think about.
That's not where I thought you were going with that at all, but okay. So Richard jumped a fence to another yard where a man was working on his daughter's red Mustang. The car was running, but it was up on a jack and boxes, so the man could work underneath it. Richard didn't see anyone around, as the man had gone inside to grab a tool, so he jumped into the running car, and he did this as the man was coming out of his house. He ran up to the car and grabbed Richard by the arm with one hand while trying to grab the keys with the other. Richard said, "Get away. I'm taking the car. I have a gun. I'll kill you." He's, like, probably just so fucking frantic at this point.
Oh, yeah. He's 100% panicking.
Yeah. The man replied, "You are not taking this car." And I hope he said it that sassy. But Richard stepped on the gas, trying to get away. The man grabbed the steering wheel, turning it, which made the car hit the chimney of the house. Not able to go anywhere, Richard got out of the car and just started running again.
He's really good at running.
Really good. It's because he's just, like, so long and thin that he's, like, a little windbreaker. I don't know if that actually makes him faster or slower now that I think about it.
Honestly, though.
When he got to Hubbard Street, he saw Angela De La Torre, 28, in a bright red dress, walking to her car, which was parked in front of her house. And she shared this house with her husband, Manuel, and her daughter, Amber. And it was actually Amber's fourth birthday, so she was on her way to the store to get some treats for her daughter's birthday. She saw Richard running towards her and immediately knew who he was, so she started screaming, "El Matador!" Richard punched her in the stomach and took the keys to the car out of her hand. Angela's neighbor, Lourdes, was actually in the car already, and upon seeing this man entering her car, she fled screaming.
I mean, we all have a fight or flight instinct, yeah. And Lourdes was flight.
Yeah, I would be too if a random man got in the car. One of Angela's neighbors, Jose Bergen, heard Angela screaming, so he and his two teenage sons rushed over there, and he told Richard to get out of the car. At this point, Manuel, Angela's husband, also came running outside because Lourdes had gone inside and grabbed him. Manuel grabbed a metal bar that was 2 feet long and curved at the end, and Richard shouted at him, "Don't come closer or I'll shoot you." Manuel later recalled that he didn't see a gun, So he opened the car door and hit Richard with the pipe in the back of the head.
Again. Whack.
Yeah. Everyone is just, like, bonking this guy when they see him. Richard got out of the car and started running. More and more people started exiting their home, carrying bats and other weapons, and gave chase behind Manuel, Jose, and Jose's two sons. This is just, like, a beautiful movie scene. You know what I mean?
It is. It's directly out of a movie because this couldn't have happened in real life.
Yeah, it's so good that, like, the community took this bastard down. Sorry, I just get so excited about it. So as Richard was running, he started looking behind him and sticking out his tongue and hissing at his pursuers, mocking them. Because he's just, like, a fucking weird dude and is doing this to be an edgelord, basically.
An edgelord?
Sorry. I just called out so many people. To edgelords everywhere, I'm sorry that I compared you to Richard Ramirez. That was wrong of me.
And so, like, I think that this is personally, like, his biggest downfall because it definitely slowed him down.
Yeah, for sure. And, like, when you got a crowd of people running after you, you just want to run as fast as possible.
Right?
So, as Sarah said, when he was hissing at his pursuers, this obviously slowed him down, and it allowed Manuel to get close enough to swing the metal pipe again and hit him in the head. This hit knocked Richard down, and Manuel stood over him and said, "Go ahead, get up, and you're fucking dead." The people chasing him all gathered around Richard and held him down until the police arrived. One of Jose's sons, Julio, said that Richard was trying to tell him that someone was chasing him, and that's why he tried to steal the car, and to just let him go. Richard was wearing black jeans and a black shirt with a white Jack Daniels logo on it. And he was bleeding from his head to the point where you could see the red blood through his back shirt. Because it's a head wound and they bleed a lot.
Oh, yeah. So one officer pulled up, not really knowing what was truly going on, besides getting a call of a man with a gun. And he saw a crowd of people surrounding one man on the ground. When the police pulled up, Richard shouted, "It's me! It's me! It's me! I'm lucky the cops caught me."
So annoying. Everything he does from here on out is so annoying to me. It aggravates me. And it's just like a fucking teenager trying to piss off their parents. So I'm sorry. I will be screaming a lot this episode.
I mean, she's not wrong. So a detective then pulls up, named Andres Ramirez, and once he saw Richard's face, he automatically recognized him. When the detective asked the man what his name was, Richard replied, "Ricardo Ramirez." After he handcuffed Richard, the detective called for an ambulance. More and more people gathered around the scene.
Yeah.
The medevac showed up, cleaning two wounds on Richard's head and wrapped his entire head in gauze. And these pictures are like whack. Like, he looks so fucking stupid.
Very dramatic gauze job.
When officers from the sheriff's office showed up, they frisked him, taking a black wallet from him. And they had also picked up his black backpack before getting to the scene. When the officer asked him if he was Richard Munoz Ramirez, Richard said, "Yeah, man, that's me." And he was officially placed under arrest. Like, he was just so nonchalant. Just, "Yeah, man."
Yeah. Just, like, shrug shoulders. "Yeah, LOL. Arrest me, bro."
So the time from when he had first been spotted to the time of his capture was only 20 minutes. Every police officer in the area started showing up, as well as the press. And as soon as they showed up, the media started interviewing witnesses, trying to get any information possible. The crowd kept growing to, like, a few hundred people.
Yeah.
And the onlookers were spitting in his direction and cursing him. As the crowd grew more and more unruly, the police decided to get Richard out of there and take him to the local police station, which was Hollenbeck. And the sheriff's office was pissed about this. And one guy said that the local PD wanted the credit of arresting them themselves. And the reason being was that this was in the was that this was in the sheriff's jurisdiction and he had already been arrested by a sheriff's deputy.
Yeah.
As they were leaving the scene, the crowd cheered, chanting, "Kill him! Kill him!" In the police car, Richard said to the officers driving, "Why don't you just shoot me? I deserve to die. Now they're going to send me to the electric chair. I was being chased all the way from Olympia, you know. All the killings are going to be blamed on me. Those people wanted to kill me." And so one of the officers responded saying, "No one's going to kill you. You are in our care and nobody's going to harm you." Which I feel like he was kind of sad about.
Yeah, I think, like, because a lot of people say, like, oh, everyone's super interested in, like, true crime now, but also always, because...
Oh, definitely.
Hundreds of people showing up because a serial killer was arrested on the streets, that's because of morbid curiosity, and, you know, it's always been happening. So at the police station, Richard kept his head down and didn't make eye contact with anyone. They handcuffed his hands and ankles to a chair, not wanting him to be able to escape. Richard said, "The automatic is at the Greyhound station in a locker. In my wallet is a ticket for the locker." Richard then placed his head on the table, facing away from the officer in the room, and began banging his head on the table while humming "The Night Prowler" by AC/DC. Richard thought he had done something to displease Satan, and that is the reason why he got caught. It's probably true.
Not because he was bad at killing people?
Or, you know, did things like fucking kill people.
Yeah.
There was an officer in the room who was directed to stay in there and just not speak to Richard, but to write down everything Richard said or did. Keeping his head away, Richard said, "I want the electric chair. They should have shot me on the street. I did it, you know. You guys got me, the Night Stalker. Hey, let me have a gun to play Russian roulette. I'd rather die than spend the rest of my life in prison. Can you imagine? The people caught me. Not the police," laughs. "You think I'm crazy, but you don't know Satan. Of course I did it, but so what? Give me your gun. I'll take care of myself. You know I'm a killer, so shoot me. I deserve to die. You can see Satan on my arm." And he then pulled up his left sleeve to reveal a pentagram that was drawn on his arm. When he noticed that the officer was writing down what he was saying, Richard stopped talking. And Detective Gil Carrillo was fucking stoked when he heard the news of Richard being caught and sped to the Hall and Beck station. Frank Salerno arrived 10 minutes after Carrillo, but had to park 2 blocks away because the crowd of angry citizens and news stations had grown so large he couldn't get any closer. Salerno and Carrillo decided before they went in to talk to Ramirez that they wanted that bag of evidence at the bus terminal to be brought in and searched after proper warrants were made.
By 10:10 a.m., the men felt like they were ready to begin the interrogation, and they had 2 others join them, Orozco and Tippin. Salerno introduced himself to Richard, who already knew who he was. "I know who you are. Yeah, you brought down Biaggi and Buono, right?" This immediately had a sobering effect on Salerno, as he had not been expecting Ramirez to know who he was. Once he was read his Miranda rights, Richard immediately asked for a lawyer, telling police that he would talk with him, but not about any of his crimes.
Yeah, he's just like, "We'll chat, it's fine."
The men worked with this and spoke to him about his life in El Paso and his family. After doing this for a while, Gil Carrillo began speaking with Richard in Spanish, and he was quicker to respond in Spanish and seemed more comfortable in general. The two men began talking more, and Richard confided to what he had been to that he had been chased and beaten up by a bunch of punk nobodies, and Gil commiserated with him. After some time of this, Gil began moving back to English and kind of asking more leading questions about his life.
Yeah.
They started getting into his father's abuse, which caused a physical reaction in Richard. Salerno was really impressed with Gil as a detective since they had never really worked together on a case before, and he kicked Gil under the table as a way to say, like, "Keep it up, good job." But Gil misinterpreted this as, like, slow down. Don't go there.
Yeah, and that is not a great thing. not a great miscommunication to have.
So after that was kind of like a little awkward silence. And so Richard became quiet and withdrawn again after Gil lessened his talking, and he decided that he wanted a lawyer for real now. So at 10:40, just 30 minutes later, the first interview was done.
Yeah.
Outside, the community was raging. The crowds had grown to over 1,000 outside of the police station, all chanting, "Give him to us! Give him to us!" The mayor arrived at the police station and told the press, "California can breathe a sigh of relief. A very dangerous man is off the streets." When it was time for him to be transferred, they would use 4 cars, 8 motorcycle police, and a helicopter to do the transport because they didn't want to risk anything happening to Richard. Once Richard was brought to the news station, he was asked once again if he would like to make a statement, and he said no, so he was booked and taken to a jail cell. Carrillo and Salerno then wanted to see the contents of the bag as they were convinced that it would help them secure him as their culprit. Inside the bag was a jar of Vaseline, a pair of black Stadia sneakers, a bottle of vitamins, a pair of brown gardening gloves, long nose pliers, locking pliers, 2 sets of keys, a .32-20 revolver, a box of ammunition for said revolver, 4.25 calibers and 22 caliber cartridges, a pair of sunglasses, a can of Weight On, and an AC adapter. Lab tests were run on the shells and slugs found at the various crime scenes to those found with Richard's stuff, and they were a match. These results also made Phil Happen think that this case was in the bag for him, as he was going to be the prosecuting attorney. Halpin was considered to be one of the best trial lawyers in the LA District Attorney's Office. He had been a council member on Charles Manson's case and secured a conviction in the Onionfield murders, which is something I had never heard of.
Yeah.
He was described as a man who would gladly fight to the death for a cause he believed in, and he even challenged one of Charles Manson's defense lawyers to a fist fight.
10 out of 10.
And he wanted to send Richard Ramirez to the gas chamber.
So, something we don't think about a ton, but we get to think about a lot more in this case because we have this source, is how Richard's family reacts when they find out that their son has been arrested as the Night Stalker.
Yes.
So Richard's brother, Robert, called their brother Joseph in El Paso and told him that their brother had been identified as the Night Stalker. Joseph took his wife, Sophia, and went to his parents' house right away. Ruth found out by watching the news. She went out and bought some beer, sat in her car and screamed and cried in disbelief, and then also went to her parents' house. Mercedes, who is his mom, if you don't remember, because that's 2 episodes ago now.
Yeah.
Ruth and Joseph's wife, Sophia, left to go to a nearby park to take in the news and cry. Mercedes looked up at the night sky and asked why. And if you guys remember, she, like, kind of knew this about her son because he had been arrested previously, and he lied to his mom and sister saying, like, he didn't do it, and so this was probably very shocking to them.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And Ruth really tried to calm her mother down, but it wasn't working, obviously. Upon arriving home, Mercedes made them all hold hands and pray, and they all hoped that it was just a big mistake. Julian insisted that it was all because Richard smoked marijuana.
And we forgot to write, but to remind you, Julian is his father.
Oh, yeah. Marijuana definitely causes you to murder people.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
For sure, for sure. So Julian got really drunk and angry and actually took out a gun, saying he was going to kill Mercedes and then himself. Joseph struggled to take the gun away from his father and locked it in the trunk of his car. The phone was ringing so much from reporters trying to get interviews that they ended up just taking it off the hook, which is, like, really common in these cases, which is unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
The next morning, news trucks surrounded his parents' home. Robert drove in from Tuscan, and Ruben, who lives in L.A., called and said that he got to Hubbard Street as Richard was being taken away and that the crowd would have killed him if the cops hadn't shown up. The family scraped together all the money they could and gave it to Ruth to go to L.A. and get Richard a good lawyer. Which I love that Ruben, like, literally lives there. And they're like, no, Ruth, please go handle it.
Right.
Richard's old girlfriend, Nancy, agreed to go with Ruth on the bus to L.A. Julian gave an interview saying that Richard was a stubborn boy and had left for L.A. at 18. He said that all the marijuana he smoked put him out of control. When asked about the murder charges, he said, "In my heart, I couldn't believe he would arrive at that. But if the authorities have proof, what can we do?" He also said he didn't have the money to get Richard a good lawyer.
Alan Adashek was assigned as Richard's public defender. Alan was nervous about this case because he knew that all eyes would be on him. The first time he spoke to Richard, Richard was humble and shy, saying that he didn't believe he would ever get a fair trial. He said everybody already thought that he was guilty, and he kind of just wanted to plead guilty to get it all over as fast as he could. Alan said that he should instead fight the case. Richard didn't like or trust Alan.
Yeah, and I just want to say this. The book often refers to Richard in this time as being described as shy. And I don't know why, but I hate it.
Really?
Yeah, because, like, when I picture shy, I picture, like, Richard, like, batting his eyes at you, like, from underneath his eyelashes. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I know that that means that's more of, like, bashful or something, but just the way that they describe him, I'm like, he's a serial killer, guys. He's not like, oh, I'm so shy and quirky. Like, stop fucking describing him as shy. What are you talking about?
He was, submissive and quiet.
Yeah, exactly. He was pissed that he got fucking caught and didn't want to talk to people about it because he was a pouty little boy.
You're not wrong.
Sorry.
So, Ruth and Nancy went to the jail to visit Richard. Ruth went to talk to him through a glass partition over the phone. Nancy stayed in the waiting area. Richard started crying when he saw Ruth, and Ruth told him not to cry. So, he stopped crying and got angry instead. You know, great switch in emotions.
Those are the only two emotions he knows.
Yes. He told Ruth that he was not the Night Stalker, but he wanted to plead guilty to get it over with. She told him to fight and not to give up so easily. She told him about how devastated their parents were and about all the news vans surrounding the house. Richard then called Nancy over. She hadn't seen him in 3 years. Richard told Nancy that he wasn't the Night Stalker and he was just being used as a scapegoat. She said that she would do what she could to help him, and they raised their hands and touched palms through the glass, like a fucking movie. And she said that she would write to him regularly. Before having to leave, Richard thanked Ruth for coming and told her that he loved her. On September 2nd, a guard in the jail saw Richard bleeding from his hand. He had cut his hand and used the blood to draw a pentagram and write 666 on the cell's floor.
Very hardcore. Yeah,
like good old Richard.
Yeah.
On September 3rd, Richard was taken to the LA courthouse for his arraignment. And a bunch of women who thought Richard was hot came to the court to see him in person.
Have you ever looked at his teeth, love?
Yeah, just don't let him smile. Before they entered the court, Ramirez said that he would like to plead guilty because everybody already assumed he was guilty and, again, wanted to get it over with.
Right.
His lawyer informed him that there were a lot of other ways they could go with the case and that he just didn't need to plead guilty. When Richard entered the courtroom, he kept his head down and put his head between his knees when they went to sit down, not wanting to be photographed. And, again, the media was surprised at how shy and innocent he was.
He's not shy.
Phil Halpin told of the 8 charges currently against Richard, which were mainly about the Bill and Lillian Doy case, but that many more were currently being drawn up, and he also requested that Richard receive no bail. Judge Soper agreed that no bail was to be set because it was such a huge case.
Right.
She said that September 9th was the next day that Richard was to be in court after the lineup scheduled to take place on September 5th.
And actually, I think it's very fitting that my binge this week is Bailey Sarian, because one of her taglines is "Get better idols." And for this next section, just keep that in your mind.
You're not wrong. That's good.
So when Richard got back to jail, he had a stack of letters from women saying that they thought he was innocent and they would do anything to help him. He also had letters from Satanists from around the country saying how cool they thought he was. And Richard really enjoyed this attention.
I'm so annoyed.
Don't make people like this your idols. Right? Like, you know what I mean? That's just, I don't get it. An award ceremony was held honoring the citizens that caught Richard, giving them all plaques of good citizenship. A woman named Doreen Loy from Burbank saw this award ceremony and didn't like that they were giving out awards before Richard was convicted. As soon as she saw his picture on the TV, she fell in love with him and she wanted to protect him.
It's love at first sight, Morgan.
Yeah. I get it. The soulless eyes. These award ceremonies also pissed off Adashek, who thought there was no way he would get a non-tainted jury pool at this point based off of all of the pomp and circumstance going on around the case. And this is like a common thing, is before anything is done in this case, like, everyone in the city has celebrated that they've caught the Night Stalker and he's going down, like, the minute he's arrested.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, while I don't like the guy, not a great look. Because if it wasn't him, they would have convicted him regardless.
Yes.
So, Richard had also told police that he mailed a lot of stuff to his family, like all of his keepsakes. So, the police went to Ruth's house in El Paso with a warrant to search her home. She willingly let them search, but was upset that they took jewelry and other items that actually belonged to her. They weren't sent by her brother.
Yeah, and the police were just like, well, that fucking sucks. Unless you have a receipt to claim it as yours, we're taking it.
Yeah, I'm sure hopefully it was returned, but I don't know. She was especially dumbfounded when the police asked her if Richard had ever sent her a pair of brown human eyes, which would be very disturbing to hear.
Yeah, it's a startling question.
Yeah. And she, in the book, she's there's a quote where she was like, no, my brother isn't a cannibal, like, or something like that. She was like, what the fuck are you talking about? So the police then went to Richard's parents' house to search their home. And when they went through, they did, like, the same searches that they did at Ruth's house. And when Julian was asked if he had ever been sent a pair of human eyes, he had to have the question clarified 3 times before it sunk in what they were asking. And Ruth said when she got to her parents' home that she could tell just by looking at her dad that they had already asked him about the eyes.
Yeah. Richard was ordered to be in a lineup in order to be identified on September 5th. Him and his lawyer felt that this was incredibly unfair, as Richard's face was plastered all over LA, and it was also well known that he suffered an injury to his head while being captured. This injury was also visible, as a portion of his head had to be shaved to get to it. Other experts say that because of this distinctive mark, they would have waited for the hair to grow back so that way this mark wouldn't be as noticeable.
But in the pictures, you can see a bald spot on the back of his head in the lineup photos. So it's...
Yeah.
That's not necessarily true by what the experts are saying.
All of the Night Stalker's surviving victims, with the exception of Nettie Lang, who is in the hospital, and Clara Hadsall, who we didn't really talk about earlier because she was just a robbery victim, not a murder victim.
Right.
So everyone but them two showed up for the lineup. And the lineup was held in an auditorium with 50 seats in it, half of which had people seated in them. So, like, that's a lot of fucking victims.
Yeah, and they had to do it twice.
Wow.
Because they had everyone sit, like, every other seat, mm-hmm. basically, but there were so many victims that they had to do two rounds of auditorium.
Wow. So, six men in total came on stage that all kind of looked similar to Ramirez, and he was number two in the lineup. But as soon as he walked on stage, the victims began to gasp and some cried. Each man had to come forward, face left, and then face right, and say, "Don't look at me, bitch, or I'll kill you." And the men had to include the word bitch in what they said, because it was something that Richard would call all of his female victims.
Yeah.
Almost everyone identified man number two as the person who attacked them. After this lineup, the victims and their relatives went to another room where all of the evidence that they had found so far was laid out. They went through and identified some of the things that belonged to them that were stolen.
Yeah.
Carol found a necklace that she said was hers, and David Knipp found a tape player that he had given to Mabel Bell. After all of this, Alan Adashek went and spoke with Richard, telling him that he had been identified and so had some of the evidence. Richard said that it was because of his image was all over the place, and at the time, his lawyer was inclined to believe him. Back in El Paso, the word of the identification spread, and his family was shocked and upset. They still all wanted to believe their son, brother, cousin, family member was innocent, and they were all concerned that he wasn't going to get a fair trial. Richard also complained of severe headaches while in jail and told his family that they thought that the guards were poisoning him.
Yeah, like on the way to his trial, he was like, "They're poisoning me."
They tried to get their son another lawyer, and one presented himself, Manuel Bizarra. He said he was going to work on the case pro bono because he knew it would give him a lot of publicity. But the only thing was, he couldn't practice law in California.
Yeah, so unfortunately, he wasn't of much help. Eventually, Adashek was taken off of the case because of Richard's anger towards him, and Barraza, although not going to be his actual lawyer, was determined to help him, so he began looking for lawyers in California who would take the case free of charge. Melvin Belli, Daniel Hernandez, and Joseph Gallegos all were up for the spot to be his new lawyer. Despite all of this trouble looking for a new lawyer, Richard was convinced he would plead guilty on his next hearing date, which was September 27th, and his family begged him not to, but he told them he was determined. Eventually, Belli said that he was unwilling to work on the case until a full mental examination was done on Richard and the family simply couldn't afford it. On September 27th, another hearing was held. District Attorney Ira Rayner announced there were 14 new murder charges and 45 other felony accounts, including rape, sodomy, unnatural acts on a minor, abduction, assault, and robbery. At this time, Adashek was still working on the case, and he went to Judge Soper and asked that Richard not be allowed into court because he was going to plead guilty against his counsel's advisement. And everyone believed that he should plead, like, legally insane at the time.
Yes, but Richard was like, "No, I'm not insane."
Yeah. So, the judge allowed this, and Richard was put in a pen where he could hear the proceedings, but not, like, actually be a part of them. So, he began screaming while in this pen that he wanted to plead guilty, and the reporters and judge in the other room could hear him. And they were just like, "Ooh, write down this gossip." Yes. And they got an extension to, like, say their plea to October 9th. On September 28th, the Night Stalker Task Force held a party to celebrate their victory, despite a literal plea not being even in yet. And around 200 people showed up to this event to celebrate, and some local restaurants even provided food for them, which just showed where the community lied.
Oh, yeah. The issue of who would be Richard's lawyer was still on the table. Richard really liked Joseph Gallegos, but Gallegos had a criminal background and had even been to jail for it. He had been arrested in 1975 after shooting a sex worker over a blowjob payment.
Yeah, he was on...
And he's a lawyer.
Yeah, he was on trial for, like, attempted murder.
That is insane.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Crazy shit.
So, Richard's family didn't like the idea of this man representing him because they felt like the media would use this to their advantage. And on October 9th, Joseph was officially announced to be Richard's lawyer, but the family was still adamant that this was not going to be the man to represent him. The press immediately began running pieces on Joseph's background. This was enough to sway Richard away from Joseph. The Hernandezes, Daniel, and Arturo took on the case. They just had to get it officially recognized by the courts. Richard agreed to pay them by signing over any rights to a book or film deal about the story to them. Judge Soper felt like they weren't qualified enough for such a high-profile case, as they had not worked on capital charges before, and they were only, they'd only been lawyers for 5 years.
Yeah, they were supposed to have, like, 50 cases under their belt or something to do a case this big.
Mm-hmm. In the court, Richard began yelling that he wanted these lawyers, putting on a big show for reporters.
Yep.
Which he loved doing. And Richard's mother, Mercedes, actually came in from El Paso to be at this hearing. And she was outraged by Richard's behavior and afterwards told him that she loved and supported him, but, like, that he couldn't act like that in court because people would judge him. And Richard just replied by being like, fuck them, they already judge me. Just another kind of quick, fun, satanic part of the story.
Yeah, because there's so many little bits of Satanism sprinkled in.
Oh, yeah. So, while in jail, Richard was visited by Zena LaFay, who is Anton's daughter, who he was the one who wrote the Satanic Bible that he read earlier. She brought her boyfriend at the time, Nicholas Schreck, who had cut off one of his ears as a sign of devotion to Satan.
They were extremists.
Yes. So Zena informed him that the Church of Satan had made him an honorary member of the church, and this made Richard super happy, and he thought that the evil forces were back on his side.
And it shows in court.
Like, the evil forces were back on his side. It sounds like a fucking Star Wars movie, let's be honest.
It really does. So on October 24th, after much thinking, Judge Soper allowed the Hernandezes to work on the case, but only after she explained all of the reasons why they shouldn't be.
Literally same.
Yeah. And Halpin was, like, really pissed that the judge did this because he was annoyed that the trial was going to take so much longer because he knew, since they were so inexperienced, it would take forever to get shit done.
Yeah, and they also had kind of, like, a reputation of, like, delaying the processes of the trial.
Yeah. So Richard, thrilled by the news, held up the card he had been holding in his sleeve all day.
Not an actual card.
Yeah. He raised his hand in the court to show a pentagram on his palm, and under that was the number 666, the devil's number.
Wow, so tough, Richard.
He smiled at the court and then at his siblings who were there, who were Ruth, Robert, and Reuben. Okay, all of them have R names except for Joseph.
I know.
That's rude.
Okay, well, like, in my dad's family, my dad's one of seven, and, like, I think five of them have J names, and then there's two that don't. And I'm like, really?
Yeah, that's a strange choice.
It is.
And Richard was proud of the uproar he caused. The lawyers asked if they could confer for a moment, and when leaving the court, Richard shouted, "Hail Satan," and threw the court into a tizzy again. The Hernandezes believed they would win this case with a not guilty plea and convinced Richard they were going to win. And everyone up until now has said the only thing that might work is an insanity defense. And they're like, no, we're pleading not guilty. So they go back into court and plead not guilty. And the court erupts again.
What a surprise.
Yeah. Judge Soper obviously brought the court back into order, and the preliminary hearing was set for December 13th to determine if it needed to go before Judge James Nelson. And by the time the hearing actually happened, It was March 3rd, 1986.
Welcome to the Hernandezes, always delaying things.
Yep. So Halpin was planning on putting 140 witnesses on the stand.
And this is just for the preliminary trial.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the Hernandezes believed that they could get a lot of the evidence thrown out that Richard had talked about before having a lawyer, but Judge Nelson ended up not throwing out anything else. The officer that found the Zazaras went on the stand and talked about finding the bodies. When he started discussing Maxine's missing eyes, Richard began laughing loudly in the courtroom.
You know, just to make a scene.
Yeah. And that's like his only goal in this trial, it seems, is to just get people to like laugh or like at him. You know what yeah. I mean? The victims that came to testify as witnesses were Sophie Dickman, Somkid Kavanoff. Yeah, Kavanoff, Maria Hernandez, Carol Kyle, Sakina Abowath, and Virginia Peterson. Some of the witnesses were inconsolable on the stand, and Sakina had to be basically carried to the stand as seeing Richard made her physically weak. Sophie Dickman and Carol Kyle were very composed while giving their statements. I'm not surprised by Carol Kyle being composed at all, considering, like, how composed she was during her whole attack.
Yeah, like, those are the two that were, like, the nurse and the psychiatric nurse. Like, they knew what they had to do. Often during the hearings, Richard would turn around and smile and wave at his groupies and try to, like, mouth words to communicate with them, which was not allowed. And he had to be warned multiple times every day about doing this. At one point, one of the bailiffs grabbed Richard by the head to force him to face forward. Richard stood up and yelled, "Get your fucking hands off me," while grabbing the bailiff. So this bailiff and two others put Richard in a headlock and dragged him out of the courtroom to the holding pen. The bailiffs were hitting Richard when he was in the holding pen, and Arturo Hernandez yelled for them to stop. Halpin told Arturo to go in there and make him stop. So Arturo took off his jacket and challenged Halpin to a fist fight. The People lawyers fight to the death. I know. So, and then the court simmered back down when Judge Nelson banged his gavel. The Hernandezes went to Judge Nelson after the hearing to complain about the excessive force used. And the judge agreed, removing the bailiff that first touched Richard from the rest of the hearings. The official charges going to trial were 14 murders, 5 attempted murders, 15 burglaries, 5 robberies, 4 rapes, 3 counts of oral copulation, and 4 acts of sodomy, and this was to 14 different households. Supreme Court Judge Michael A. Tynan took over the case for the trial. As the Hernandezes kept pushing the trial date back, jury selection didn't begin until July of 1988.
So what, we're 3 years out now?
Yes. Jury selection took 6 months and was made up of basically just Hispanic and Black people.
Hmm.
There were 7 females and 5 males.
That's
and
interesting, because usually, like, in those kind of cases, it's like an all-white jury.
Yeah, right?
You know what I mean?
And then they also had 12 alternates in case anything happened.
Right.
During this time, Richard and the fangirl from earlier, Doreen Loy, started writing letters to each other, and they eventually met in June of 1988. During their first meeting, they told each other they loved each other, and Doreen would visit him as much as possible, believing that she was the only one out of his groupies that actually wanted to help him and not just, like, live out this sick fantasy. Doreen told Richard that she was a virgin and wanted to lose her virginity to him, and this made Richard believe that she was the one for him, as she had saved herself for him.
I don't know if she saved herself specifically for you, no. Bud, but sure, you can think that way.
It's Satan's way, Morgan.
Yeah.
So,
praise Satan.
It's hail Satan!
No, that Sabrina the Teenage Witch show, they all are like, praise Satan.
So Doreen always also brought Richard anything he wanted, buying him clothes, and making sure that he always had money in his commissary. As the trial went on, Doreen was the only one of his groupies that was there for every single court date. So she was, like, dedicated.
Yeah, for sure.
Richard's sister, Ruth, wanted to be at the trial to show support for her brother, but since she was a potential witness, she was not allowed to be there. So she would travel to LA on some weekends to visit with Richard.
We finally get to the actual trial, and in Halpin's opening statements, he described the crimes and evidence they had against Richard, as well as the different witnesses he would call to stand. Jack Vinko, Jenny's son, was the first witness, and the defense tried to use their time with him to say that he or his brother was the one to kill Jenny. Which, come on, guy.
Like, what a douche.
Yeah. Maria Hernandez's case was next, and she took the stand and described her experience, then identified Richard as the culprit. The defense tried to say that she was only able to identify Richard with the help of Gil Carrillo and his mugshot on TV, because her original description of her attacker didn't exactly match Richard. Again, memory is not infallible, but it's fine.
Yeah.
Pertaining to Veronica Yu's murder, the defense tried to convince the jury that it was Veronica's boyfriend who killed her instead of Richard. When Richard was asked to stand and turn to the side for a witness to properly identify him, Richard refused to do so, shouting in the court. On February 14, 1989, they moved on to the Zazara murders. The defense wanted to tie the murder of the Zazaras to potential mob ties, but the judge didn't let Hernandez ask any questions to the witnesses about this. When the prints on the Avia shoes found at the Zazaras came up, Daniel brought up the fact that the Avia shoes were never found on Richard and were actually never found at all.
So after this, the trial didn't reconvene until March 6, as Daniel Hernandez had worked himself so hard until he was sick, and his partner, Arturo, basically gave up and hadn't been to court since the jury selection months prior, so Daniel was working on the case all by himself.
Nice.
So Judge Tynan ordered Arturo to come back. And in order to give the Hernandezes some help, the defense team brought on another lawyer, Ray Clark. And literally everyone was happy about this because it meant that the case would move on more quickly.
Yeah.
During the trial, Richard often thought about suicide. He thought that if he just got up and headed to the door while he was in the courtroom, that he would be shot down, causing it to be over so much quicker. He also thought about killing himself while he was in his cell, but he was on suicide watch and guards were constantly checking in on him. Richard said that if it wasn't for the love letters and books that he was sent from his admirers, he would have just done himself in. Lillian Doy was too sick to testify in court as she had had a stroke, so her daughter Linda testified on her behalf, as she had also helped her mother fill out the police reports after the attack. Mabel Bell and Florence Lang were the next case to be talked about in court. The doctors that worked on Ma and Florence took the stand. The courtroom was silent when the rape against Florence was discussed, but the new attorney, Ray Clark, got the doctor to admit that she couldn't be 100% sure that Florence was raped, as there was no seminal fluid, there was only vaginal stretching. The gruesome photos from this attack were then shown to the jury. Clark's defense strategy was to prove that someone else did the crime, as there were no fingerprints on the soda cans that had been drunk, and some hairs found at the crime scene didn't belong to Richard or either of the sisters. One of Maybelle's sons testified that he went and saw his Aunt Florence the next day, or the day before. She was still in the hospital, she couldn't speak, and had to be fed through a tube. He said that she could move her head to look at you, but you really just couldn't be sure if she knew who was really there to visit her.
That's really sad.
It is.
So Carol Kyle's case was up next, and she took the stand to testify for herself. She walked to the stand very confidently and looked straight at Richard. She was showing that she was not frightened by him. She testified that the first thing he said to her was, get up and don't make any noise. She then recounted everything from that night, including the sexual assault, which she said only lasted 3 minutes.
Which I feel like is kind of like a sly to Richard.
Yeah, like get riggedy riggedy wrecked, son, right? Basically. The defense tried to argue with Carol, saying that she wouldn't be able to see her attacker that well in the night, but Carol did not budge and said that Richard was 100% her attacker. In Mary Cannon's case, there was a lot of debate whether or not to show the pictures of the murder between the defense and prosecution. The judge allowed photos to be shown of the body, but only after it had been cleaned up. The defense tried to say that the Avia shoe prints were found in another room, not in the room where Mary was killed, so they could have come from someone other than the killer. In the case on Whitney Bennett, hold on, just to go back, because they keep bringing up the shoe thing.
Mm-hmm.
We've already agreed that there's only 6 in the entire of LA County, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So somehow the other 5 shoes possibly made it into Mary's apartment.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Cool, cool, cool. I just wanted to make sure we are all on the same page.
I mean, that's what the defense does. Yeah. Take what it can.
I know, I know. It just, like, angers me, and I know it's their job, but it angers me.
Oh, yeah, I know.
In the case on Whitney Bennett, the 16-year-old who was beaten with a tire iron, she took the stand herself, which, brave as fuck, you go, Whitney.
Yes.
She talked about how she had to be in the hospital for 8 days and has had 4 operations at the time of the trial. She was still seeing a plastic surgeon to reconstruct the bones in her face that had been damaged, which, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and this was, like, 4 years later at this point. And, like, they said she was, like, a beautiful woman at this point and everything, but that she's still, like, the bones in her eye socket were still damaged.
That's horrible.
Mm-hmm.
One of the jurors, Maria Santos, worked with Steve Bennett, Whitney's father, so she ended up being excused from the jury based on Richard's wishes. Any connection at all, and Richard's like, get them out.
Oh, every time.
Yeah. In Joyce Nelson's case, Frank Salerno testified, and the main subject was on the Avia shoe, since the shoe print was imprinted on her face. Sophie Dickman testified on the stand and described her attack, but could not identify Richard as she had not been wearing her glasses. She said that her sexual attack lasted 2 minutes, and the defense used Sophie's bad eyesight as a reason that she wouldn't have clearly seen who was attacking her that night. For Max and Leela Knighting's case, their daughter took the stand and talked about finding her parents' bodies. The prosecutor didn't ask her any specific questions about the condition she found her parents' bodies in, as they had photos to show the jury, and these photos were the most graphic ones shown yet. As always, showing the gruesome photos to the jury was a big topic, as the defense didn't want the jury to see them, so the judge agreed to take out some of the photos from evidence.
Pertaining to Chengaron and Somkid Kovanoff's case, Somkid took the stand, and there was actually no one to babysit Somkid's daughter, so Doreen volunteered.
Hate that.
Yeah, the woman who's obsessed with Richard. And so she wasn't in court that day because she was watching the child in the hallway.
Hate it even more.
So Somkid was very emotional during her testimony, and when asked if her attacker was present in the courtroom, she pointed at Richard. Richard then made, like, a snarl face at her and started laughing, which made Somkid cry even more. The next case that was talked about was the Petersons. And Virginia Peterson took the stand. She described being shot and falling into bed and watching her husband grappling with the attacker. She was sure and confident about all of her answers, and when asked questions, she did not get emotional, which made it very hard for the defense to try and trip her up.
Peterson is cool, like, in her final statements, too. Like, she's just a badass lady.
She is.
Virginia is her first name. I couldn't think of it off the top of my head, but Virginia, you're a badass lady.
So, in Sakina and Alias Abouath's case, Sakina testified, and she was very emotional during the testimony, but was able to tell the court of all of the events pertaining to the attack, including Richard making her swear on Satan. And during her testimony, even Judge Tynan had tears in his eyes. After identifying Richard as a culprit, she stood up and yelled, "You son of a bitch! Why did you kill him? I gave you everything, you bastard!"
Go her.
Yeah. Throughout all of the other cases, one of the defense's strategies was to ask whether they saw pictures of Richard on the TV before pointing him out in the lineup, saying that their minds told them to point him out only because they had seen his picture before. Which makes sense. Mm-hmm. The defense couldn't do this in Sakina's case, though, as she had not watched TV or left her house since her husband's death, which this was all part of her grieving culture in her country, the Union of Burma in Southeast Asia. Donna Myers, who was Richard's friend, Jesse Perez, and Felipe Solano, who was his fence, and basically all of the people involved in the capture of Richard, took the stand next. And Richard's fence, Felipe, was actually given immunity for having the stolen property by testifying against him.
Which makes sense, because he didn't know that it was from murder victims, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
And throughout this whole thing, Richard, of course, just kept, like, fucking with the court. And at one point, he puts, like, reflective tape on his notebook that he took every day and just, like, used it to shine light into the judges and other people's eyes just to fuck with them.
Yeah, very annoying shit.
Yeah. And so, all of this was just the prosecution's case. Now, it was the defense's turn. And Richard didn't want to put up a defense, calling the whole trial a joke. And it took his family, lawyers, and a specialist to finally convince him to go on with the defense. And after it was decided that a defense was going to take place, Richard was taken out of the courtroom and snarled at the media, shouting, "Media! Sensation-seeking parasites!"
Which, I mean, he's not wrong, but yeah. Because it's him, hate it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So the defense trial started on May 9th, 1989, and Daniel Hernandez started with the opening statement where he basically was just pointing out weaknesses in each case. He focused a lot on other fingerprints and hairs found at the crime scenes that didn't belong to Richard or the victims. The defense had even hired private detectives to go back to some of the houses and recreate the environment for photos to prove that a lot of the victims would not have been able to see their attacker's face.
Which is, like, a lot to go through.
It is. I guess, like, do what you're gonna do for your client, you know?
Very true.
It's because of who the client is that you're just like, nah. When Gil Carrillo took the stand, things got a bit testy. Daniel began questioning him about several things, most of which were objected to by the prosecution, and eventually they just got so frustrated that they moved on to a different witness due to time constraints, being like, we have to get through all of these other people. We can't just be here all day with with Carrillo.
Yeah.
So that was kind of Daniel's, like, bag. The judge was tired of Daniel at this point and made several snide remarks to him during sidebars. And this is my personal fave. If you begin the usual meandering that I put up with for the past 2-3 years, I will probably change my mind about allowing you or taking you at your word that you are simply laying a foundation. Because he was just, like, setting up such leading questions. Yeah. So Julian, Richard's father, was called to the stand to testify that his son had been in El Paso during the Bell and Lang and Kyle attacks. What?
My dog.
Oh.
And this was the first time that Julian actually came to L.A. for Richard's things from El Paso.
Yeah, because he was, like, so deeply ashamed by it that he mm-hmm. was not coming to town. He said that his son was in town for his granddaughter's communion, and the prosecution said that he had to be in L.A. to commit these crimes. So the defense brought in relatives and family friends from El Paso who testified that Richard was at his niece's communion on May 25th, 1985. A photo of Richard with his family at the communion party was put into evidence, And one of Richard's sister-in-laws testified that he didn't leave town until May 29th.
And just for reference, the Maubel and Florence murders happened on May 30th. So if he had left May 29th, he would have had to, like, scramble home and immediately just commit it.
Right.
So Alan Adashek, who was Richard's first public attorney, was called to the stand. And it turns out that one of the jury members had actually gone to school with him. And Richard said that this ruined his jury's impartiality, and he wanted the man removed from the jury. The man was removed, and put in his place was this alternate juror, this woman named Cindy Hayden, who was a girl that led Richard to believe she would never convict him. And this angered the prosecution, as they all noticed, like, all of the intense looks that Richard and Cindy would give each other.
Yeah.
And, like, Cindy was basically in love with him.
Yeah, and when she got put in as the alternate juror, she literally just, like, went up to the sedan smiling.
Mm-hmm.
And Daniel Hernandez turned to Richard and was like, it looks like she just fucking won the lottery. And he was like, that's because we have.
Yeah. And so Cindy had actually moved to L.A. to fulfill her destiny. When she got her jury summons, she thought that, like, this was her big break. Like, she thought that her destiny was serving on the trial for Richard Ramirez.
Yeah.
The defense brought in a number of witnesses who were at the lineup to testify that they saw multiple police officers hold up two fingers while at the lineup, and Richard was number two. So the defense was saying that the police told the witnesses to pick Richard out of the lineup.
In the police's defense, they said that they were holding up a V for victory, which is the funniest shit I've ever heard, because you absolutely were not.
So, to lay in another little fun fact, actor Sean Penn, when he was married to Madonna, punched a photographer and was sent to jail for like 30 days. And he was actually in the cell next to Richard. When Madonna came to visit Sean, she saw Richard and asked Sean who that good-looking guy was.
So even Madonna thought he was hot.
And Sean was like, that's the night stalker you want to meet him.
Jesus.
And so Richard asked Sean for his autograph, and Sean wrote to him, quote, "Dear Richard, it's impossible to be incarcerated and not feel a kinship with your fellow inmates. Well, I've done the impossible. I feel absolutely no kinship with you." And Richard wrote back, "Dear Sean, stay in touch," and hit him again.
Nice.
Closing statements started on July 15th, 1989. And Phil Halpin's argument took 4 full days. And the defense started their closing statement on July 24th. And it only lasted 2 days, which is still a long time, but not 4.
Yeah, I mean, but you also have like a 4-year-long trial at this point,
too.
That's
true.
So on July 26th at 11:25 a.m., after a 14-month-long trial, the jury finally began their deliberations. The juror, Cindy Hadden, played devil's advocate for Richard and asked questions in his favor for each crime before it was brought to a vote. Juror number 4, Lee, soon became a problem. He kept falling asleep during the deliberations, and soon the other jurors wrote a note to the judge, and Lee was kicked off the jury.
Like, imagine being on the jury for Richard Ramirez and thinking it's so fucking boring you just fall asleep.
On August 14th, juror Phyllis Singletary didn't show up. The judge found out that Phyllis had been murdered, and the media tried to construe that Richard Ramirez was behind her murder, but unfortunately, it turns out that she was beaten and shot in a domestic dispute with her boyfriend, and an alternate juror was chosen to replace her. Richard was upset about the trial going forward after this, thinking that the jurors' thoughts would be tainted by it, and had an outburst in court the next time he was there, saying that he never wanted to go back into court again because the trial was a joke. So he was carried out of court. The jury reached a verdict on September 20th, 1989. Everyone was summoned. Richard was brought in, but refused to put on a suit, so he just wore his prison blues. And Richard didn't want to be in court, so he was actually just kept in the holding cell to hear his verdict. At 2:12 p.m., the jury voted guilty on all 46 counts. The penalty phase started on September 27th, and Richard didn't want to put up a defense for the penalty phase, especially if anyone in his family were asked to take the stand. When told that if he didn't fight, he would be executed for sure, Richard said that he would rather die than live the rest of his life in a cell. The prosecution argued why, in each case, Richard should be given the death penalty, and Halpin said that Richard Ramirez was the personification of evil. And Richard just stayed silent as Halpin went through each case. Ray Clark stood up for the defense, asking for mercy, as Richard had let some people live. He said that life in prison without the possibility of parole meant that Richard would never be free, and that was punishment enough. The jury started at the deliberations for the penalty phase the next morning. In all, it took the jury 5 days to get through all of the charges, but they voted that he should receive the death penalty for each first-degree murder charge. While voting, they wrote their votes on little pieces of paper, and as this went on, the jurors began drawing little nooses and tombstones on their pieces of papers while they voted, including Cindy. And Richard says that he knew, like, how they had voted the moment the jury walked in and all of the women on the jury were crying.
So, sentencing was set for November 9th. At this hearing, the judge spoke about each crime committed by Ramirez before asking Richard if he would like to address the court. And obviously, Richard did. But this was the first time he, like, officially spoke out. Richard said, "You don't understand me. You are not expected to. You are not capable. I'm beyond your experience. I'm beyond good and evil. I will be avenged. Lucifer dwells in all of us. I don't know why I'm even wasting my breath, but what the hell? For what is said of my life, there have been lies in the past, and there will be lies in the future. I don't believe in the hypocritical, moralistic dogma of this so-called civilized society. I need not look beyond this courtroom to see all the liars, the haters, the killers, the crooks, the paranoid cowards. Truly, the trematodes of the earth. You maggots make me sick. Hypocrites, one and all. We are all expendable for a cause. No one knows that better than those who kill for policy, clandestinely or openly, as do the governments of the world which kill in the name of God and country. I don't need to hear all of society's rationalizations. I've heard them all before. Legions of the night, night breed. Repeat not the errors of the night prowler and show no mercy." After this, the judge gave his sentence. Richard received 19 death sentences, one for each murder and 6 for other crimes. He was to be put to death by the gas chamber, and he was also sentenced 6 years for each of the other 33 charges. And after the sentence was read, Richard said, "Big deal. Death comes with the territory. See you in Disneyland." After this, some victims and their families gave impact statements, including the Petersons and some of Jenny Vinkow's children. And Virginia Peterson had a longer impact statement, but it was beautiful, and honestly, we highly recommend looking up the whole thing.
Yeah.
And here are just a couple quotes from it. She said, "It has been 4 years since the attempted murders of my husband and myself. An act which only took seconds, yet to this day reverberates with the original horror. Nights are the worst. I suffer from a sleep disorder in which I wake up many times a night, sometimes with panic attacks." So, the trial, all in all, ended up costing $1.8 million, which was the most expensive trial in California history until the O.J. Simpson case. After Richard was sentenced, Doreen still visited him, doing anything that she could for him, and they ended up striking up a real romantic relationship. She also became good friends with his sister Ruth, and she even flew to El Paso to meet his family once. Richard proposed to Doreen in 1988, and on October 3rd, 1996, they were married at San Quentin State Prison. She would also frequently say, to the media, that she would commit suicide if Richard was ever executed. They eventually separated after 9 years together, and there were rumors that they separated because of Richard having hepatitis C, or because he had been blamed on killing and raping the 9-year-old girl, Mei Lung. In August of 2006, Richard had his first round of appeals. He really wanted a retrial, but the California Supreme Court denied this request. So he just continued seeking appeals. And due to California's lengthy appeals process, people estimate that Richard would have been in his 70s by the time he was executed. But that didn't happen. Richard got sick, and he also suffered effects from his chronic substance abuse in the past, and also a chronic hepatitis C viral infection, which caused his liver to fail. He also suffered from B-cell lymphoma, which he ended up succumbing to, dying on June 7th, 2013, at the age of 53.
And that was Richard Ramirez.
That is the end. Our, million hours of episodes.
Yeah. We hope that you guys freaking enjoyed that deep dive.
Let's hope so.
It was intense, but it was fun. And Richard is a little baby.
He is. He's just, a little toddler throwing temper tantrums throughout the whole thing just to get attention.
Yeah, and it's I'm sorry, sir, you murdered people, so now you have to go to trial for it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm really sorry about your luck, but that's what happens. But we hope that you guys thoroughly enjoyed this episode.
Please check us out on social media. We're on Crime Binge on Twitter and Crime Binge Podcast on Facebook and Instagram, where we post photos about the crimes. And also remember to check out our website, which is crimebinge.com.
Yeah, make sure you are making your submissions for ideas of episodes and any of your listener stories to crimebinge.com. That's where we're taking our submissions. And leave a 5-star review if you can on Apple Podcast. And
keep on binging.
Bye.
See ya.